fasten your seatbelts, and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
The ship of state launched 1848 on the Union flag flying down up to where we are. We are sailing all together on the good ship Wisconsin under the 30th star. The ship of state launched 1848 on the Union flag flying.
Born in 1848, Wisconsin, our nation's 30th star, has a fascinating history that includes stories and connections the average Wisconsinite might not be aware of. Today on Route 51, we'll take a dive into such topics as Hollywood's Golden Age, hops and wheat, human digestion, and the Civil War with Brett Barker. Brett is a professor of history at UW Stevens Point at Wausau, where he's taught since 2002. He has a special interest in Wisconsin's impact and evolution during the Civil War. Brett, welcome back to Route 51.
Thanks.
I'm Rick Ryer. We'd like to hear from you, too. Join the conversation at 800-780-9742. Again, that number is 1-800-780-9742. Brett, you wrote the book, Exploring Civil War Wisconsin, A Survival Guide for Researchers. How did that book come about?
Well, Rick, this is an idea of the Wisconsin Historical Society. I was someone who was very aware of the sources available about Wisconsin during the Civil War, both the soldiers who went off to war and the home front. And this is really a guidebook for people who are interested in either doing genealogy about people living on the home front or researching their Civil War soldiers that went off. And that's kind of a how-to book.
How many Wisconsinites served during the Civil War?
Well, over 92,000 Wisconsin men went off to the Civil War, served in the Union Army, which is kind of remarkable if you realize that the 1860 census, the whole population of Wisconsin, was only about 775,000. So about one in nine people living in Wisconsin during the Civil War served. And you figure women and children who obviously weren't serving, that's a tremendous percentage of our population.
That's incredible. How many lives were lost?
Over 12,000 of those 92,000 men didn't come back. And about of those, more than two-thirds of them from disease, but then also another third from battle. So if you think of 12,000 casualties, men who didn't return home from the Civil War, that's a tremendous sacrifice that the state made to preserve the Union and to end slavery.
Now, Camp Randall in Madison really was the epicenter for Civil War activity here in the state. What was its significance during the Civil War? And tell us more about Camp Randall.
Sure. Well, Camp Randall had previously been the state agricultural grounds. And to think about the way in which Wisconsin was different at the time, Camp Randall was described as being a mile west of Madison during the Civil War. So Madison, obviously a much smaller place at the time, about 6,000 people. It had been the state agricultural grounds, was converted as a training camp, and it's about where 75,000 of those 92,000 men entered the service. Most of them volunteers, and they were brought there. They came by companies of 100 men. They were then formed into regiments of 1,000, and they trained, did some basic training, and entered the military service there near where Camp Randall.
And what other thing, you know, they came in, they mm-hmm. were trained, but there was also another significance about the POWs from the Confederate side that actually were housed there too.
Right. So in the spring of 1862, the Confederates in the Western Theater had had a lot of men taken prisoners, some of them at a place called Island Number 10 in the Mississippi River. And the traditional places where Confederate POWs being held were overflowing. And so some of that excess was actually sent up to Camp Randall, and several hundred Confederates spent the spring and early summer of 1862 there in Camp Randall as prisoners of war. And over 100 of them ended up dying there, mostly of disease. A lot of them came in really bad health, and I don't think the climate probably helped them. A lot of them were from the Deep South. And it was kind of interesting because during this time period, many Madisonians walked out to Camp Randall just to see real Confederates, to see what they looked like. They were our countrymen, but we, of course, were a much more local country. And so they went to go see what did these Confederates look like. And they looked a lot like, Union people, but just not, you know, but Southerners. So, yeah, it was quite a curiosity for a while.
Now, you said about 100 or so of the Confederates had died at Camp Randall, and they were buried in the Madison area.
Right.
What was your reaction when the Confederate monument was removed from one of the cemeteries at Forest Hills earlier this year?
Right. It's interesting. An earlier monument, which had – I think had a little more controversial language. It didn't surprise me when that was taken down. But this latest one mostly contained their names, and their names do appear individually still on the headstones. But I guess the Madison City Council felt that really there was no need to sort of celebrate any sort of part of Confederate history within Madison. And so they took that down recently. Those men are still buried there. One of the curious facts is that's the furthest north any group of Confederate veterans are buried together anywhere in the world, because this is as far north as basically prisoners went. And so it is a part of our history. It is a controversial matter, though, particularly when Confederacy came up. The Confederate flag used to fly over that little soldier's rest too, and so those symbols are complicated and controversial, and will continue to be, no question.
How many regiments did Wisconsin have that were based out of Camp Randall?
So most of them went through about 75 of the about 75,000 men. Wisconsin had 53 regiments of infantry, and again, about 1,000 men, 4 regiments of cavalry, some artillery, and a couple of miscellaneous units. So most of them would have begun their military career there. There were a few other camps scattered throughout the state, but they weren't nearly as large or as important as Camp Randall was. Named after, by the way, the Republican governor at the time, and that was very much the model in the North. You generally name the camp, you put it at your state capital, and you named it after the current governor.
Okay.
So that's Camp Randall.
Makes sense. Now, one of those regiments, the 15th, I believe it was, was really quite unique in not only in Wisconsin, but it was a unique regiment overall throughout the war.
Absolutely.
Chock full of Norwegians.
Yeah, they're the Norwegian regiment, right? this was a group that was purposely put together by mostly Wisconsinites. A few Norwegians came in from neighboring states, but overwhelmingly from Wisconsin. And they really wanted to show that their group was – they were good immigrants. They'd come and they now wanted to serve their country. But it is a fascinating regiment. There are 1,000 men in that regiment. 130 of them were named Ole. 15 of them were named Ole Olsen. And the rest of the regiment, if you read regiment rolls, they're Goodman, Goodmanson. They're very Norwegian. It was so Norwegian, in fact, they had Norwegian leaders. They gave commands in Norwegian on the battlefield. They wrote their unit histories after the war in Norwegian. This really is a source of tremendous ethnic pride for those people. During the war, their colonel Hans Christian Hegg, who was killed at the Battle of Chickamauga in 1863, there's a large statue of him at one corner of the state capitol grounds in Madison. You can still visit today. And so he remains really a touchstone for the Norwegian American community. There's a duplicate statue back in Norway of him. He was an immigrant himself. And so that's one of my favorite regiments. There are also regiments that had heavy German representation alike, but Norwegian, the 15th is probably the purest ethnic regiment, certainly amongst Wisconsin's regiments.
Now, there was also an interesting figure, if you will, and wasn't even human, that presided over many battles throughout the war. Old Abe, tell us that story.
So Old Abe was brought as a little eaglet, one of the members of the what would become the 8th Wisconsin Infantry, brought him as an eaglet down from northern Wisconsin, came with the regiment to Camp Randall, grew up, and then accompanied the regiment on the battle. He had a special little shield-shaped little stand that he would sit on. He had a little guard. he would go into battle as such. I mean, not on the front lines, but he was present during many of the battles and became very much a potent symbol for that regiment and in some ways Wisconsin during the war.
Now, that actual Old Abe became a symbol for the what was it, 101st Airborne?
101st Airborne. The Screaming Eagle and 101st Airborne is Old Abe. Many people don't know that. But one of the original elements that was put into the 101st Airborne organized near Camp McCoy and adopted that old symbol. So he's still very much alive today.
Now, Old Abe also brought some controversy following the war. As a matter of fact, I understand that there was a famous suffragette, Lily Devereaux Blake, who asserted that Old Abe was actually female.
Yeah, that old Abe had laid eggs at some point, right? And so this was a matter of some contention. The men who had served with the 8th said they were pretty sure it was a male eagle, though I'm not sure how that occurred. But yeah, that was always the assertion was that old Abe was a male, which is probably more about masculinity in Union soldiers. Mm-hmm. And you know, it is a little complicated to figure out because the old Abe died as a result basically of smoke inhalation. He lived in the Capitol after the war. He went back and lived in the state capitol, died as a result of a fire, and then he was preserved. But that body was burned in the 1904 Capitol fire. And so really very little survived of old Abe. So if you see one that's a stuffed replica, it's a replica. It's not the original old Abe, right?
Right. But what I understand through time, this controversy actually lasted many, many years, decades.
Decades.
And as a matter of fact, there were still some feathers of the original old Abe that were somewhere out there.
Yep.
And they were used. First of all, I got to figure out how they even came to be used in this experiment in 2016.
So so there's this strange story. After the body of old Abe is burned in the 1904 Capitol fire, the governor, and this is all revealed in a wonderful exhibit at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum in Madison, the governor asked people who had visited old Abe in the Capitol, many children and others had taken a feather from the bottom of the cage that old Abe had shed, taken home as a souvenir, and he asked that they send all these feathers back. Apparently they're going to create some sort of a Frankenstein's monster of an old Abe. They, of course, couldn't do that, and that was abandoned. But many of these feathers did end up in the State Historical Society's collection so that we know we have some of the feathers of old Abe, and apparently that's what was used for the DNA testing in 2016.
And just a couple of years ago,
yeah.
and it was determined officially that old Abe is –
It's a he. Old Abe was a male,
it's
right?
A
so old Abe
story.
Was a male. So, yeah.
Tell us about Lewis Harvey.
So Lewis Harvey was the governor after Governor Randall. He was elected in 1861. And in early 1862, he heard that there had been a large battle called Shiloh in Tennessee. Early in the war, neither side was really prepared for the amount of casualties that were coming from these battles. They were bloody affairs. And so he gathered up lint, nurses, medical supplies, everything he could, and led a relief expedition down to the Shiloh battlefield. And while he was there at night, he was passing from one steamboat to another on a gangplank. He slipped off the gangplank and drowned in the Tennessee River. And so our governor during the Civil War drowned in Tennessee. It's kind of a horrible story. Yeah. His widow Cordelia went on to do great work. She ended up serving as a state military agent, headed the soldiers' orphans home after the war, and did a lot of – she turned her personal grief into a lot of public good. And so that's another one of those just things if someone wrote in a novel, you probably wouldn't believe it, but it really did happen. So we lost Governor Harvey in the spring of 1862.
Wow. You know, one of the things that has always intrigued me about the Civil War, Brett, was the prolific writing of letters between soldiers and their loved ones back home on the home front. And many of those letters have been preserved and collected at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum in Madison. And what strikes me with many of those letters is how poetic they were. Is that something that you touch on in your teaching and research? And tell me a little bit more about the correspondence that happened between the soldiers and the home front.
I do like to use them. Those primary sources, I think, make history come alive, and I like to use the actual letters of soldiers. It's a magical moment in American history. The vast majority of Wisconsin soldiers could read and write, and yet there was not yet any military censorship. So people wrote back and forth whatever they wanted. And so we have literally hundreds of collections of letters, mostly in the State Historical Society, also in the Veterans Museum, from all these soldiers that you can go and hold in your hands today and read. And they are often poetic. And even when they aren't poetic, I think they tell us so much about the ordinary person in the American past and what their life was like.
And you'd mentioned before we came on the air, there was one particular letter that was written on the back of a label.
Yeah, I think it's a condensed milk can. I'm not positive. I'd have to go check. He was in a Confederate prisoner of war camp, and the only paper he had was a label off of a tin can. So he peeled the label off and wrote it on the back and mailed that home. And that's still The actual can label is still in the archives with his letter written on it that you could go visit today.
Oh, that's incredible.
Usually they used paper, but they're more usual stationery, but there are exceptions, right?
So. And one of the things that really inspired, I believe, Ken Burns in his series, that his film, The Civil War, were those letters.
Yes, I think so. And I mean, he used the Sullivan Blue letter. It was an Illinois a Rhode Island soldier. It's in the Illinois State Archives now. But there's so many from Wisconsin. And I mean, there are hundreds of letters from, you know, William Ball of Monroe and the Hulbert brothers of Milton, or letters that I used, and Dyrest on the home front as well. And so there's a lot of words from the past that are just remarkably inspiring. And I think that's what gets people interested in history.
We're talking with Brett Barker, professor of history at UW-Stevens Point at Wausau, about little-known Wisconsin history. You can join us at 800-780-9742. Again, that number is 800-780-9742. I'm Rick Ryer. Wisconsin is still called America's Dairyland, but when we come back, we'll look into what Wisconsin was known before dairy. First, here's a piece from Madison-based duo Count This Penny, and it's based on a letter 7th Wisconsin Infantryman John Hunt wrote while a prisoner of war in Gettysburg. It's called I'll Take a Walk.
A call to arms, 1861. I worked my farm, more work than I could get done. And they need more men on the battle lines to take their place. I'm a man of peace, but for these enemies, it's a fight I will embrace. I'll take a walk. Oh, I'll take a walk.
Let's go to Tennessee.
So we came down to Nashville to the Grand Ole Opry.
Little Dolly Parton and Porter Wagoner this morning. Milwaukee, Here I Come. We're back on Route 51 with UW-Stevens Point at Wausau's Brett Barker, talking about Wisconsin historical facts that you might not know. What about our state's past would you like to know about? Call us at 800-780-9742. In the late 19th century, Wisconsin became known as the Dairy State, officially adopting the title of America's Dairyland in 1940. Brett, tell us about what we were producing quite a bit of before milk and cheese.
Yeah, you know, I think we've been the Dairy State for so long that people forget that there's an earlier history. In the early decades of settlement, we were first a wheat state above all else. Wheat was an easy crop to grow. It didn't take a lot of labor. It was a great frontier crop. And for a brief period in the 1850s and in the early 1860s, Wisconsin was really the center of wheat production in the United States, and Milwaukee was a milling center before it became associated with beer much later.
Well, what drove that wheat production?
It was really opening up the new lands and a lack of really first-rate competition. It was the best place to probably grow that wheat early on, corn more to the south, but wheat was a really good crop early on, and it was it took off and sort of grew by leaps and bounds throughout, as I said, the 1850s and 60s, as more land in the southern part of the state opened up to cultivation.
And how did this increase demand derive industry and technological developments on the home front during the war?
Well, one of the things that the Civil War did bring about was obviously when all those men are off to war, there's a labor shortage. And so particularly in 1862, when a lot of those men are really gone, wheat is a crop that has to be harvested very quickly, or it drops its heads, it kind of drops the useful fruit. And so The women went into the fields in 1862, and also there was an increasing drive to mechanization during the war to make up for the labor of those men. And so they managed to get the wheat crop in 62, 63, and 64 and keep going during the war.
And what – you know, it's interesting. We had such a big boom in wheat production, and all of a sudden it slowed down. What happened?
Well, the short answer is – we could not – well, there were the chinch bugs came and sort of – there were some problems with blight and with insects. But the big problem was we couldn't compete with areas to the north and west. Once Minnesota and the Dakotas, Indian peoples were dispossessed of their land and white settlers moved on to that and the railroads reached there, they were better areas, more fertile areas, and Wisconsin just couldn't compete. And so it just slowly declined. And Wisconsinites began to look for another crop, something else to do to replace wheat.
Interesting. And mm-hmm. that crop was
for
hops.
Briefly, it was hops, right? So then there's a hops craze. And so suddenly in the 1860s, starting around Sauk County, also a little bit in Sheboygan County, I believe, there is a hops boom. And suddenly everyone's growing hops because that's so it turns out hops had traditionally been grown back in New York State. A lot of folks from New York State came to Wisconsin as they migrated west, similar climate. And particularly in the 1860s, New York had a few problems. They had some insect infestations of aphids on their hops crop. And so there was a vacuum that Wisconsin farmers moved into. And suddenly everyone was planting hops all over the place. And so in the 1860s, we then briefly became the hop center of America.
Kind of like a chameleon, whatever people wanted, we kind of changed to
yep.
that. And now, right now, we're experiencing quite a craft beer boom. And because of that, there are a lot of local brewers rediscovering and experimenting with abandoned hops that were actually growing in the wild. When the hops what factors led to Wisconsin hops heyday just after the Civil War, and what led Wisconsin farmers to abandon the crop?
It was mostly that New York had a really bad decade in the 1860s because of both weather and infestation, and the price went up, mm-hmm. and so there's a great demand. They moved in quickly. Wisconsin farmers adapted and started growing it. And then the problem became that there was overproduction, and then New York got back in the game. New York had a commercial advantage to where most of the breweries were at the time. Wisconsin would later sort of take off in the brewing industry. And so again, Wisconsin sort of lost to its competitors. Other places could grow hops more efficiently and at a lower price. And it was as most great booms were, there was a lot of money to be made and then suddenly it was gone.
Now, then that transitioned over to dairy.
Yeah.
How did that transition from grain to dairy come about, and how did we become a cheese powerhouse?
Yeah, so what happens is essentially dairying is often what goes on land that other is marginal in some ways, but it's good for pasturage, it's good for haying. You can build a good dairy industry on it. So by the late 1800s, Wisconsin started to move deeply into the dairy industry. We also had pioneers here like Stephen Babcock, who developed a milk fact test. That you could immediately test someone's milk and tell how much butterfat there was in it. And that was critical because otherwise, if you couldn't do that, then somebody could simply water their milk down and get as much money as somebody who was spending the time and effort to make really rich milk. That helped the industry. And then there's William Dempster Hoard from Fort Atkinson, who is a tireless advocate on the national stage of dairying. He has something called Hoard's Dairyman, this weekly newspaper that was nationally circulated. And he constantly is telling Wisconsin farmers how to go into the dairy industry, what you need, how to be successful. And so we really have a lot of advocates that helped farmers find their way into the crop. And then it became sort of a lifestyle in Wisconsin.
And it's still
it still is today. To this day, right?
It's incredible. Which now this does lead us to the discovery of digestive science. And I know, Brad, you're chopping at the bit to tell us the story.
Well, this is one of these curious things that does have to do with Wisconsin history. It starts in the early 1820s. There was a French voyageur, a French fur trader named Alexis Saint-Montan, and he had suffered a wound which usually would have been fatal. He'd been shot in the stomach. And normally back then that would prove fatal. For whatever reason, he recovered. But when he recovered, there remained an open wound into his stomach with a flap of skin over it. And a army surgeon named William Beaumont got interested in this and began to explore what was going on in San Martin's stomach. And he'd done this up on the Straits of Mackinac, but then he Beaumont had become post-surgeon at Fort Crawford near Prairie du Chien, and he brought San Martin down and began to do instruments, these experiments. He would take meat, other foods, and sort of place them in his stomach for a certain period of time, then pull it out and see what's happening. And that seems the oddest thing, and yet this was the way that the medical industry actually learned how the medical sciences learned how digestion occurs within the human body. And so much about that we take for granted, things like gastric juices and the way that the stomach breaks down products and all these sort of disgusting things when you think about maybe on some level. I often feel for Saint Martin. I mean, you know, this guy, I don't know how much fun it would have been to have somebody sort of opening up a flap and sticking things into your stomach. And
I was just the whole thing.
You know, I think he was doing it. I think he was paid for it.
I hope so.
You know, and I hope – and Beaumont was a tireless investigator, but at some point you can understand where he might have just said enough. But so much about really the way the stomach works was a mystery, and he really advanced medical science in a very way because this
wow. –
and who knew that that was part of Wisconsin's past as well.
That is incredible. and along with that kind of discovery with the digestive science, the University of Wisconsin at Madison has been at the forefront of so many discoveries and patents and so on. Coumadin is one of those things that came out of a University of Wisconsin.
Absolutely. I should have given, by the way, when we were talking about the dairy industry, I should also – beyond Babcock and Horde, the UW itself, and particularly Extension, you know, they offered something called the Short Course, which taught dairy farmers sort of how to go into the business. They offered advice to dairy farmers. The Extension was really so critical in helping dairying become associated with the state as well. And they continued to do research. In the early 20th century, Wisconsin researchers and men like Harry Steenbach discovered vitamins. And they invested the profits from those patents into something called the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, or WARF.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the brand name for that blood thinner is warfarin. It's WARF with the warfarin. So
that's where
Wisconsin,
that came from.
Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. So many people have been on warfarin, a blood thinner, right?
Sure.
And that actually, the W in warfarin is for Wisconsin. And so we were also leaders. The university was leader in the idea of the development of vitamin and many other drugs that came out of the proceeds, which were placed into this foundation, which then could fund further research, and this day is a giant research institution down on Madison's campus.
That is fascinating. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. Thanks for sharing that, Brett. We're talking with Brett Barker here on Route 51. You can join the conversation at 800-780-9742. What about Wisconsin? Seems maybe a little odd to you that Brett can shed some light on, perhaps, whether it be back with our earlier discussion about the Civil War or other discoveries here in Wisconsin, 800-780-9742. And Brett, kind of keeping on this food theme here for a moment, malted milk was invented
in Wisconsin. There's so much milk around that a lot of innovations in milk and cheese occurred within the state. Malted milk, Horlick. William Horlick is associated with that. I'm not sure about the first name, but Horlick is associated with that. And Racine, that many people know. I think there's still a Horlick Park there in Racine to this day. And malted milk was an important product. I think has declined. Many people now probably know it as sort of in malted milk balls like Whoppers or whatever, but you can still get a malted. And that was a product that has a Wisconsin connection as well, along with, we were talking about earlier, sort of, you know, Colby cheese, named after the man's – I believe the man's mother was from Colby, Wisconsin. So that's a Marathon County connection, right? And there is just so much. Almost any major development that has to do with milk and condensed milk, the pages of Merrill had a lot to do with the condensed milk industry in the United States. Almost everywhere you look, if it's about cheese or milk, there's probably a Wisconsin connection built in there somewhere.
And then you just look down the road from our studios here, and Way itself has used to be something the dairies would throw away. And now, well, throw away, there we go, throw away the whey. But now it's been packaged in a protein drink and rediscovered, if you will, for health.
Yeah, for health and bodybuilding. Yeah, it's now a major industry in the state, right? It's now, I think, pushing its way up against other traditional things like cheese and cranberries and the like.
Yeah, so Wisconsin, back in the day of when these things were being discovered, whether it's digestive science or whether it's malted milk, it seems that these people that created these things or discovered these things were really truly entrepreneurs. And Wisconsin is a bed of entrepreneurship.
Yep.
Back in the 1800s as it is today.
Yeah, I think so. I think both the way in which Wisconsin has constantly adapted and the way in which I think the university and individual farmers and other people have worked together over the years to improve the economy of the state, I think, is a critical part of the state story.
Are there other food products that you would like to mention at this at this point that really had their start in Wisconsin?
Well, I don't know about start, but I mean, I think that many people know that cranberries are sort of a national leader in cranberries, but things also like, I think we forget about things like canned vegetables and how important that was in the state's history, as sort of peas, green beans and the like. A huge part of Wisconsin's agricultural history. And of course, particularly in this part of the state, ginseng being an interesting part, not exactly, but an agricultural crop, certainly. I think we dominate national production in ginseng. And again, that's a story of Fromm brothers from northern Marathon County and the way in which they were innovators and the way in which they developed a crop that had grown wild and they found a way to cultivate it and to make a living out of it. And it's now a huge industry in central Wisconsin and beyond.
And, of course, the hamburger was invented in Seymour, Wisconsin.
Yes.
Incredible.
Yep.
When we come back, we'll find out about two traveling salesmen and how they met in a small Wisconsin town and started an international ministry. Plus, we'll discover the connection Tarzan has with the Badger State. Stay tuned. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I've been to Edgerton, Darlington, Middleton, Hubbleton, Hub City, Cuba City, Genoa City, Ashburn, Ashland, Packwalk, Pewaukee, Waukesha, Conemaugh, Wapak, Milwaukee, Wausau, Wauwatosa, Wapon, Watertown, Waterloo, Whitewater, Whitefish, Bay, Manners, Bridgewater's climate.
I've been over there, hey, smelled that dairy air, hey, once a Bob Clare, hey, thought I saw a bear, hey, I had a creep of that state fair, hey, I've been over there.
Welcome back. I'm Rick Ryer on Route 51 with Brett Barker, history professor at UW-Stevens Point at Wausau. Turning our attention now to some slightly more obscure events and people in our state's history. There's still time to join us if you'd like with your questions or comments about Wisconsin, 800-780-9742. Okay, Brett, two men walk in a bar. Okay, in this case, perhaps, maybe a coffee shop in Boscobel, Wisconsin, and started a movement. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so these were two traveling salesmen. They were both devout Christians, and one night they met. They both happened to spend the night in a hotel in Boscobel, and they began discussing just how hard it was to maintain, stay on the straight, narrow path as a traveling salesman, staying in a different town, a different hotel every night, and how easy it was, how they had tried definitely to stay faithful to their faith, but how they knew many other men hadn't and how it was very difficult. And was there something could be done to help people constantly remain in the presence of religion even when they were traveling? And so they later sort of continued to correspond. And that is what the Gideon Internationals developed out of. So anyone who's ever stayed in a hotel or motel room and saw that Bible, that started in a Boscobel hotel over 100 years ago with two traveling salesmen who wanted to make a difference in the world. And I think it's hard to argue any sort of more omnipresent than the small Gideon Bible in every hotel and motel room, I think, worldwide now. I think they've given away hundreds of millions of Bibles over the years.
How did they fund those in the early days?
Yeah, I don't know. Early on, they started out, I think, actually were taking collections and using going from congregation to congregation, trying to raise. And eventually, they started developing sort of a membership system. And they now have – and you may see that people occasionally go out and hand out Bibles in certain public places and the like. And they now are funding. But I think it's mostly coming through donations from religious organizations.
Oh, interesting. Well, then there's Tarzan, King of the Jungle. What possible connection would he have to Wisconsin?
You wouldn't think he does. But, of course, Tarzan and the original, the very original. Part of the problem with the Tarzan legend is there have been so many books and then by Edgar Rice Burroughs, but then so many films. Tarzan's become part of a larger, I think, cultural phenomenon. But if we go back to the original book, Tarzan of the Apes, sort of at a climatic point, Jane goes to Africa. She meets Tarzan. Then she decides to leave. And she goes back, and it turns out she lives near Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And at a critical moment, a major fire breaks out, and Jane is in a peril. And suddenly, out of nowhere, Tarzan swoops in and sort of saves her from this giant fire. And that's part of the sort of the climactic moment of that original novel by Edgar Rice Burroughs, which is sort of remarkable. There's a Wisconsin connection. Rhinelander, Wisconsin.
A lot of interesting things happen in Rhinelander.
And I don't know exactly why Burroughs was from Chicago. Maybe to him, he thought of that as the nearest place that was a deep woods that would be, you know, in some ways the same as an African jungle.
And Tarzan just appeared.
And Tarzan just appeared.
In the nick of time. And speaking of fires, the Peshtigo Fire started the same day as the Great Chicago Fire. However, a lot of people still don't recognize or even understand that there was the Great Peshtigo Fire, which had a great significance. And tell us about that.
That's right. And it's one of those things, you know, Burroughs, by the way, in that novel, I think he's more or less using the Peshtigo Fire as something, even though that didn't occur near Rhinelander, to sort of it's a Peshtigo-like fire that Tarzan saves Jane from. Well, the Peshtigo Fire, as you said, started the very same day as the Great Chicago Fire. Many people know that sort of the story of much of Chicago burning down and the legend of Mrs. O'Leary's cowl knocking over the lantern and all that. But on the very same day, there was a much bigger and more devastating and more deadly fire in Peshtigo and another area and in nearby areas, particularly at the root of Door County as well, much more damaging. So in Chicago, 300 people died and 2,000 acres were burned. In the Peshtigo Fire, between 1,500 and 2,500 people died and 2.5 million acres were burned. So it's not even the same in any level, right? And yet, I think the Chicago Fire to this day is better known, certainly to people outside of Wisconsin. And part of the reason I think has to do with the fact that it was Chicago. And little old Peshtigo is way up in the North Woods and kind of not in the center of things. And the other real short-term problem was Peshtigo was so devastated there was literally no way to get word out for a couple of days of just what had happened. This was a massive fire. That part of the state had been incredibly dry for an entire year. And when they were lumbering at the time, they would leave lots of waste lumber and sawdust and all sorts of things laying around. So it was just a tinderbox. When it went up, people literally ran for their lives. Some people were incinerated as they tried to run away. It was a horror show. And yet most people, even in Wisconsin, heard about the Chicago Fire first because news quickly – part of Chicago was left and they could send out word. So much so that one of the famous stories about it is that the governor of Wisconsin had started to collect supplies to send off to help people in Chicago. And the train was about ready to leave for Chicago when news had reached that this Peshtigo Fire had occurred, actually turned the cars around and headed them northeast because now he knew there was need within the state. But that's how long it took. And I think that honestly, I don't know if this is the only cause, but I think that longstanding rivalry between Illinois and Wisconsin is partly over things like this. You know, we had a bigger fire that was more deadly and more damaging, and yet what people know about is the Great Chicago Fire and Mrs. O'Leary's cow.
Yeah. And in 2019, we're still at it.
We're still doing it, right?
And speaking of 2019, and you were alluding to news coming out of Chicago, the media landscape at the time, it is Oscar season.
Indeed.
And I'd be remiss if I don't ask about Wisconsin ties to Hollywood's golden age. Let's see if listeners can recognize this voice.
There will be 100 million people right here in this country who will be shocked and offended and appalled at the two of you. And the two of you will just have to ride that out, maybe every day for the rest of your lives. You can try to ignore those people, or you can feel sorry for them and for their prejudices and their bigotry and their blind hatreds and stupid fears. but where necessary, you'll just have to cling tight to each other and say, screw all those people. Anybody could make a case, and a hell of a good case, against your getting married. The arguments are so obvious that nobody has to make them. But you're two wonderful people who happen to fall in love.
Brett, who is that?
That, of course, is Spencer Tracy from Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, right? One of his last role on film. And Spencer Tracy grew up in Milwaukee and has that connection with Wisconsin that I think maybe a lot of people aren't really aware of. We sort of think of Spencer Tracy as being from everywhere, right? He's sort of that ultimate sort of Midwestern, maybe American who isn't from a particular place, but he is from Wisconsin. And so he's one of – certainly one of the most illustrious of the Golden Age with a Wisconsin connection, but not the only one.
And well, not the only one. Tell us more.
Right. So I'm trying to think of other people. Orson Welles has a connection with Kenosha as well as Don Ameche. Yep. Agnes Moorehead, which I was laughing, you know, a lot of people know her as the mother on Bewitched, but of course she had an illustrious film career and things like The Magnificent Ambersons with Orson Welles. She was from Reedsburg. And so there are those much more recently. People may know Chris Farley was from Madison, right? So there are connections from all over the state and in the golden age of Wisconsin and those connections. And even earlier, though they didn't appear in many films, Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne, who were really dominated the Broadway stage for decades, had their major house, Ten Chimneys, which is west of Milwaukee, where many great legends, Charlie Chaplin visited all the time, Douglas Fairbanks Sr., sort of all these people, the early golden age of Hollywood, visited little Genesee Depot and went on up into I think that's where they got off the train and went up to Ten Chimneys. And so there's always been this Hollywood connection.
And that's Ten Chimneys is still a major destination here in Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
And beyond the Hollywood side of Wisconsin fame and fortune, musicians, for example, Les Paul.
Les Paul. I think Les Paul and his influence on popular music, right, with the guitar is just hard to even quantify. I think is incredibly important, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Georgia O'Keeffe.
Georgia O'Keeffe. I mean again, I think because of her work, many people think of the desert, and she spent a lot of time out in the West, obviously, but she is from Sun Prairie. Mm-hmm. And so I think that when you think about famous people, Georgia O'Keeffe's childhood in Sun Prairie is one that you don't often think about. Literarily, Laura Ingalls Wilder started her life out in Western. The first book, The Little Cabin in the Big Woods, starts out in Western Wisconsin, right? There are I would argue that the whole areas that we really didn't kind of cover, but there's whole other areas where I think Wisconsin's made that kind of contribution.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other areas too we didn't cover yet, and we still have some time to do so right now, is our Native American history.
Yeah.
And I know that's another major interest of yours, Brett. Tell us a bit about that and how that relates to today's relationships with our Native peoples.
Well, I think one of the things that is interesting about Wisconsin is, except maybe Oklahoma could make a claim like this, I think we have about the most interesting history of Native peoples of any state in the United States, in the sense that there were some Indian peoples living here at the time of European contact who are no longer here. The Dakota, that is the Eastern Sioux, moved to the West. There are others who were removed, like the Sauk and Fox. There are Native peoples who were here at the time of contact who are still here, the Ho-Chunk, the Menominee, the Ojibwa. And then we also had Indians who were removed here from the East. So we have the New York Indians, the Oneida, the Stockbridge Munsee, the Brotherton. So we have a very complicated – obviously we still have a Native presence here that is important and enduring. And so I think one of the things that a lot of people I think is unique about Wisconsin's history – so often we think about the frontier as being the West, a Western frontier. Wisconsin, the story is really the Northern frontier, that many of those tribes were able to preserve a land base in the northern part of the state where a lot of the reservations are today over time. And there are a lot of great stories there. One quick one I'd love to tell is that the Ho-Chunk, there were several attempts to remove the Ho-Chunk, and I think they're to this day very proud of the fact that they simply continued to return to the state. You can try to remove somebody, but if you just are stubborn enough to just keep coming back, this is our home and this is where we intend to live, they persevered long enough that there is still a Ho-Chunk presence here today. There are a lot of other stories. Chief Buffalo, an Ojibwa chief, at over 90 years of age, he went east to go talk to the president to Washington, D.C., which was no small thing back then in the 1850s, traveled at the age of 92 back to argue that his tribe should receive a reservation, was ultimately successful, and they were not removed out of the state. And I think my students are often just really amazed at the idea of a 92-year-old making, in that time and place with crude transportation systems, right, making that kind of journey.
Incredible. In our last remaining minutes, Brett, what about Wisconsin's just varied history that we haven't talked about? Mm-hmm. But what really has struck a chord with you over the years that you just keep coming back to?
I think one of the things I love is that I think we tell our stories well. I think that we had a historical society that existed 2 years before the state did, that we have collected our stories, and the State Historical Society, which is a gem, has preserved those stories and has been actively seeking. You know, we talked about Civil War soldiers' letters. Mm-hmm. There were four times as many soldiers from Ohio during the Civil War, another place of study, as Wisconsin. And yet there are 10 times as many collections of Wisconsin soldiers' letters in the Wisconsin Historical Society than there are Ohio soldiers in the Ohio Historical Society. So we've been preserving forever. One story I love to tell people is at the beginning of the Civil War, Lyman Copeland Draper, who was the recording secretary sort of in charge of this Historical Society, asked the state government, why don't we give every soldier a pocket diary when they go off to war and ask them to donate it to the society when they come back so they can preserve? And he was told that that was impractical because it might cost the state $100 to do that, which was a lot of money back
sure.
then. You know, that was a fair amount. But I've often thought, boy, I would love to go back and donate $100 so that we would have, yeah, you know, 90,000 soldiers, even if half of them preserve their memories, we'd have 45,000. But that was the sort of forward-thinking historical society we've always had. And that's why I think we're able to tell our stories and we have those rich collections. Indeed, the Historical Society has most of the major Hollywood studios, their archives are there in Madison that we can go and look at and be a part of today. International Harvester has a major collection there. So I think we're good at telling our stories, and I hope we continue to tell our stories as a state, because we do have a unique tradition I think is unlike any other.
Now, how long have you been teaching the Wisconsin history course?
Well, since I came here in 2002, I taught it not long after. It's not as often. It used to be required of a lot of social study teachers in the state, mm-hmm, and it's no longer a requirement. There are other things they can do to meet that requirement, but it's still a course that I find students are interested in, and I have senior auditors, that is retirees who can come and take a class for free and just sit in on a class, who are very interested in learning more about the history of the state in a way that maybe some other topics wouldn't interest them as much.
How has the engagement with students been, whether it the auditing seniors, mm-hmm, or your traditional students, as you're teaching the course and opening their eyes? It's like, really, that's here in Wisconsin?
Well, part of the fun is teaching them about who people are like Spencer Tracy.
Sure.
It may be hard for some of the listeners. It's hard for me. But, you know, Spencer Tracy died just a couple of weeks after he filmed that scene for Guess Who's Coming to Dinner in 1967, 68, somewhere around in there. So he's been gone for 50 years. So it's not he was gone long before people born today. And so kind of reinvigorating that history and telling people who these folks are. They're often deeply inspired by these people from the Wisconsin's past who did all these, made these tremendous achievements.
What would you tell somebody who would come up to you and say, what's the point? What's the point of teaching history? Why do we do this?
Well, I think partly it is to understand who we are and how we got here. I mean, one of the major things that I think history can do is can tell us who we are and explain who we are as a people. And so I'd argue people in Wisconsin might – the most natural place you might start is the history of the place that you live and the state in which you live. You can expand it out from there in many different ways, and I think there are interesting stories anywhere. But I think that if we don't know where we came from, we will be more poorly informed on where we're going.
Thank you, Brett.
Mm-hmm. Thanks
for joining us today. Brett Barker is a professor of history at UW-Stevens Point at Wausau. I'd like to thank Joy Ratch-Kramer for producing today's program and providing on-air production. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today from the Blue Canvas Orchestra, Count This Penny, Dolly Parton and Porter Wagoner, and the Gomers. We also heard, of course, from the late Spencer Tracy. Today's program will be rebroadcast Friday night at 7 on 90.9 FM and will also be available on our website later today at WPR.org/Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer. We'll be back next week for a special journey along Route 51. Until then, we're heading out of town.